I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Snark Monkey episode number 23 with Austin Winsberg. I'm going to try and keep this quick because we cover a lot of territory, Austin and I. He is a very talented, very funny writer, producer in television, as well as on the Broadway. on the Broadway? I was recommended, Austin, by a former Snark Monkey subject, Bob Cushell, another very funny, very talented writer, producer in television. He said that Austin would be a great guy to talk to, and part of the reason was because Austin, at a very young age, 26 or 27, was given the job of running a show on network television, a show he pitched and got sold and ran for two seasons with some very frustrating processes along the way. And he talks about that quite a bit. He has certainly continued to do very well for himself since then, but it's a good story, starting from the mean streets of Brentwood, California, college on the mean streets of Providence, Rhode Island, a little bit of Catskills musical theater summer camp in the midst of that, some finger banging. John Stamos is involved. Not in the finger banging. I don't think so. I don't know. You'll have to listen to find out, won't you? And a lot of stuff in between. And also coming full circle to realize a dream, I guess, of putting a musical on the Great White Way. We cover all that and more. And he gives you some really practical advice in terms of breaking into the business, despite the incredible frustrations of trying to do something creative in a world that sometimes doesn't know what that word means. Pretty great stuff. And also the search for happiness. Oh, God, we do cover a lot, don't we? We find the meaning of life here. It's Austin Winsberg, and we laugh a lot. Very, very funny. You got to check this one out. Snark Monkey number 23. Enjoy. Pick up practically everything you say.
Fantastic.
So if you want to mutter under your breath about me or about Bob Cushell, yeah, see, I heard every second of that. Do we want to get the big rift between you and Bob Cushell out of the way? Just kind of...
There's something.
Yes.
Are we starting?
Yeah, we started.
When did we start?
No, like seconds ago.
Well, I thought I was going to get an introduction or something.
You will. You'll.
I
get
thought
it.
You were going to play a little of little Bette Midler for me.
Boy,
from a distance.
People are so in show business. They're so used to this kind of constructive format.
I just thought you were going to play me in.
No, there's going to be music. There's going to be a little introduction. Here's what I do.
I don't know if you know anything about me. Though. What are you going to say?
But
in
intro? I give you an introduction after I've interviewed you.
Oh.
And after I have an impression of you.
Uh-oh.
But not while you're around.
I
and you can only find out about it after the fact.
Well, then I will stop trying so hard and just be way more laid back so you can have just nice and positive things. That guy, big personality, trying way too hard. Very Bob Cushell of him.
Yeah,
see?
That's
do you
right.
see what I did?
It's
I brought
become,
it back
exactly.
For you.
And that's the way people talk about it. He's become a descriptor. Oh, wow, that's way too Bob Cushell.
What, descriptor?
Yes. A descriptor? Is that a word?
You're
the writer.
I don't know.
Austin,
I, for one,
Bob Cushell said that I would have a fascinating conversation with you because you're talented, you're funny, and you are one of the, I believe he put it, annoyingly youngest people to ever get a start in television and have some success at it at a young age.
Yes.
Is
maybe
that
one or
accurate?
Two of the, one or two of the things he said may have been true.
Right.
No, I did. I think my one of my dubious claims to fame was I had my own TV show on ABC, I think at 26 or 27. So I think I may have been the youngest showrunner in ABC history. It's done a lot for my career since then, clearly. But yeah,
no,
so
but
I think there was a moment
major.
In time where I was the young. I'm certainly the youngest or one of the youngest showrunners.
And that show was
called Jake in Progress. And that was on ABC for a couple seasons.
John Stamos. Yeah, and that was a nice show. That was a good show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I watched that.
I can tell you all the. I mean, if you want to spend an hour just on that, I can tell you all the machinations of everything that happened through that process.
Oh, we're going to know.
Because that's a fascinating development insight into the TV broadcasting business.
We're here for 4 hours, so I think we can cover it.
Where
you are from Southern California.
I am, yes. L.A. native, born and raised.
It's weird how many of those I talk to because L.A. has the reputation of people being from somewhere else everywhere here, and I am one of those. But but there are way more natives and way more people in the entertainment industry.
Do you find that those natives are actually sometimes more normal than you would expect? The normal in quotes, but I mean, yeah. You know, like
I've always been a defender of L.A. as it's not the cliche phony. I mean, the entertainment business is a huge part of what happens here, and only people in the entertainment business hang out with people in the entertainment business.
Right.
I mean, almost everybody has a relative who was like a set decorator or, yeah, he worked in construction and he was over at Warner Brothers or whatever. But the percentage of people who actually are involved in entertainment, because it's such a huge area. I mean, people work at factories and they work in offices and they work at, the Kinko's and, it's a normal place. If you hang around normal people, you will find normal people.
Right.
If you just hang around entertainment types, then yeah, I would imagine you would probably have a bad taste of this place.
You know, it's interesting because I grew up I was a bit of a child actor, and I also grew up, I went to private school and I had friends whose parents were big in the industry, and my best friend growing up was a famous child actor. And
who was that?
Fred Savage.
Oh, wow.
So Fred Savage was maybe the biggest child star when we were growing up.
Right.
And so even despite the fact that that was my life and I was exposed to that, we still had a very normal childhood. We weren't going and doing blow off of hookers' backs in clubs when we were 15 years old. We were going to like the lame restaurant down the street and seeing movies in Westwood. Like,
right.
You know,
well,
our life was very sheltered and very as much of a normal suburban childhood that you could have growing up in Los Angeles.
My kid went through the same thing. He went to private school in the Valley and then went to Notre Dame. And he, as early as elementary school, maybe third grade, there was a set of twin girls, I think, in his class who would be gone several days a week because they were playing one kid on Days of Our Lives or something.
It was not the Olsen twins.
No, it was not. Oh, boy, if that had only been.
No, but my sister was in Tori Spelling's class in elementary school.
There you go.
And, like, we would notice certain things that would be a little different than what would maybe be the norm. Like, everybody would do their science projects in sixth grade, and they would come in with their little volcanoes or whatever. There was a Tori Spelling hologram that they brought in for the class. And also, right. I remember that I think for her birthday party in sixth grade, just looking outside at that painting, I believe Michael Jackson came and sang, "Hey, happy birthday."
That's
so
awesome.
You know, there were those little things. But even within that, it was like we didn't.
Yeah, you weren't thinking in terms of.
You live in Minnesota and you're like, Michael Jackson came. That's crazy. But we didn't think of life in a way that felt that different. I don't know.
No, you were still growing up. You were still a normal, with this normal kid and teenage problems. I get that. And that's my point about L.A. I mean, until you're embedded in entertainment, that's all that you ever do. And if you shun all your old friends only for those, show busy friends, then you have a skewed perspective on stuff. And anybody who comes out here specifically for the entertainment business, that ends up being all they hang around is other people who have that same thing. Now, you grew up in what area? West LA.
Brentwood.
All right.
OJ Land.
All right.
OJ Country.
Is that what they call it now? Did they change the signs?
Yeah, it's called OJ Land now.
That's just for the TMZ tour.
Yeah, no, it's a theme park.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
It's... You can only be this tall.
I have a lot of jokes in my
there's
head.
There's a lot. There's something about...
They don't feel topical anymore, so I'm not going to do them.
I don't know. We were out in the hallway discussing Judge Ito and it went on for a good 15 minutes.
You think the OJ jokes are coming back? Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Should we bring them back?
Somebody made a reference to the fact that Judge Ito had a different was it TV or radio station mug on his judge's thing
table every day, like he was like he had sponsors.
I talk for a living. You write for a living. We can have
to think of the judge's table bench. The judge's bench. Approach the bench.
Yeah, because it was televised. He had a different.
So he was like sponsored every like a NASCAR.
It was exactly. He had a different mug up there with a different logo on it every day.
Do you want to hear I have two big OJ stories.
Yes.
Do you want to hear them?
You have the fact that you have two of them is amazing. Yes.
The first is people say, like, you grew up in L.A., you must have, like, amazing celebrity stories, like celebrity run-ins or that kind of stuff. One of my celebrity run-ins is I could think of, like, two people. I mean, I don't want to name the other one, but I can think of, like, two people that were, like, not very nice to me when I asked for an autograph. And one of them was I was in a liquor store with my mom when I was 7 years old. Why I was in a liquor store, I don't know. But,
I'm glad you added with your mom.
I went over and asked for an autograph from O.J. Simpson. He signed it, but he was not particularly nice to... Who's not nice to, like, a 7-year-old when they ask for an autograph?
Yeah, a kid and a football star.
But I remember thinking... And I probably didn't even know that he was the football guy. I probably just saw him in Naked Gun or something. But
he was Towering Inferno guy for me.
Yeah. So, but for whatever, my memory is that he was not particularly nice to me.
Yeah.
And the second was...
did he try to kill you?
Yeah, so then he tried to slash my throat.
Oh, wow.
And then I ran out of the liquor store, but he didn't get there. And maybe that's why he was angry, because he didn't really accomplish it.
And he harbored that resentment for years.
For a long time.
Oh, bummer.
So this is my second OJ story, just because all roads lead back to OJ.
Somehow they do.
Is that my father was an architect and an interior designer, and somebody had bought Nicole Simpson's condo to, like, redo it, to live there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, a few years after she passed away, like, the murder site. And they brought my dad in to do it, and he turned it down because he felt like there was bad juju around it, and he didn't want to be associated with it.
Ah, that's interesting. Wow. What did your dad do?
He was an interior designer,
Interior designer.
A little bit of architecture, but more interior designer.
And your mom?
A little bit of real estate stuff.
Okay.
She owns and runs a building.
All right. So what kind of kid were you? Were you, class clown? Were you a nerd that got beat up? Were you a jock
What are you picking up on?
if you had
to guess.
I think you were smart.
Okay.
I think you were you hung with the smart kids. See, I always, people, when I classify myself, I never fit into that clique. I was the dumbest kid in the group of smart kids, how I like to put it.
Okay. So I'm getting that vibe.
Yeah, thank you. So I was able to kind of cusp into other areas.
Uh-huh.
Never a jock, really, but I knew him, and I made him laugh and that kind of thing.
You're a floater.
Yeah, absolutely. I maybe a sociopath. Maybe I was just codependent. I needed to please everybody that was around me.
Well, that sounds like me.
I had a lot of issues. Yep. But I would say you were a very smart guy, that maybe there was athletics early on in your life, but you were – I don't think you were a full-on nerd. I think you were liked and likeable, at least at that point. And you
before it all went south.
Yes, clearly you're not now. And maybe in drama because of the child actor.
Because I mentioned the child actor thing, so
yeah.
I get a little bit that away. Yeah, not far off. I mean, the athletics. I played tennis. That was my main sport.
All right.
Maybe that's that's a little bit of the Southern California thing. Like, we played tennis.
We all had to do something.
The Jews have to do something, and like, we don't like contact sports, and so we would play tennis.
All
so
right.
I played some tennis.
All right.
And
Jews play tennis. All right.
That's allowed. I think I wouldn't say I was part of like the popular clique, because there was that was sort of the jocks and like the mean girls,
really beautiful people.
I was a floater. I was friend. It was important for me to be liked, and I was kind of I always want from every my. I mean, this is the therapy coming in of like wanting to be liked by everybody. But yeah, so I was friends with lots of people. I had a core group of friends, but I think that sort of ballooned out to being friends with lots of people in different groups. I was very active in the theater community at school.
Yeah.
I was in my school. I was a prefect, which is kind of like being senior class president. Like, we would run the assemblies and be in charge of like the
prefect. Is that a common term? That sounds,
at my high school, that's it was called.
That sounds like European, like something out of some sort of.
I feel like it's like a boarding school thing or something like that, or maybe there's a European quality to it. But for whatever reason, my school had four prefects, which would be the guys who were in charge of student council and running the assemblies, and so. But you have to get voted on for the school to be that. So
right.
That was the school saying, we accept you. We pat you on the back.
I had a similar thing. I was like a president of National Honor Society or something. You had to get up and make a speech, and I remember making people laugh. And so I honestly believe that's why I got the job, which I promptly reigned over the National Honor Society, you know, membership and did nothing. I don't think I did anything,
really?
But it made for a nice letter on my jacket at the end of the year.
I did a lot.
Were you very active?
Very active.
I was very lazy.
Very active. I believe the year that we were prefects... I believe that we started the school carnival that year. That's still around. I believe there was some sort of talent show night that may have been created that year by us that might still be around.
Did you have a cause? Were you trying to invoke change in the school charter as an active prefect? Do you have a mission, a vision?
Yeah, you know, I was very concerned about poverty and world peace.
No, you weren't.
No, I mean, my mission...
the carnival?
The carnival and the talent show. We were raising money. No, my issue was, you know, I had to be in front of the assemblies a lot. So my issue was trying to make people laugh and entertain. And I actually wrote certain things for those assemblies. And one of those things I kind of got known... I mean, this is senior year, but one of those things I kind of got known for was like writing skits and sketches and stuff like that that would be at those kind of assemblies.
But I bring this up because that's... That's such a formative time because it really does kind of – college defines you in a certain way, in a different way, and we'll get to that because you went to Brown, and that's a completely different experience than you grew up with.
Certainly.
I would imagine that was by design. You wanted to transplant yourself.
That really stems from the other thing that was really kind of life-changing for me, which was camp. So I always went back east to camp every summer.
Oh, wow.
Starting in eighth grade.
You have family back east?
Nope.
No?
Nope.
So, okay.
I think my parents had an awareness, and I must have had this awareness too, that I was going to end up in the entertainment business. I started reading Variety when I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I was like a walking IMDb before there was IMDb.
What now, with parents who had apparently zero connection to entertainment, what spurred that on?
It was me.
What were you watching? What were you seeing? Old movies or as a comedian?
I mean, I was watching a lot of TV back, you know, when I was 8, 10, 12 years old. Three's Company, mm-hmm. Different Strokes, mm-hmm. Growing Pains, Webster, those kinds of shows.
Golden Age.
Quantum Leap, Miami Vice. You know, these are the shows that kind of pop into my head.
All like
Knight Rider.
Yeah, hugely influential stuff.
But it was.
None of which holds up, by the way.
How dare you?
All right,
those were my formative years there, and those were the three. Honestly, though, of all those, I mean, I loved the two things that the two shows that really were my thing that I was a little obsessed with were Three's Company and Scooby-Doo. Scooby-Doo was another big thing for me when I was a kid.
Right there with you.
And then the one that really transformed it for me, which showed me the power of television, my obsession with how TV could be more of a conversation, more of a cultural thing, was Twin Peaks when that came on.
Oh, okay.
So I was like in eighth grade when Twin Peaks came on.
So you turned a little corner there with something that was totally off the grid from what you were used to growing up.
Yeah probably. I mean, and just in terms of sort of the extended storytelling of that, mm-hmm. and like I got roped into like those, like I read like the Diary of Laura Palmer.
Was
like, they didn't have message boards, but if they had, I would go to whatever the equivalent of message boards were. Like I would write down notes during, and I wasn't nerdy like this.
I wasn't one of those
like kids who was like, you know, like I was obsessed with Who Killed Laura Palmer.
Well, no, that was one of the first shows that ever had this kind of ancillary
life to it.
Yeah, exactly. That grew out of that, which just enhanced that feel. It was pre-internet in a way that, you know, there was no website to go to and kind of, you know, join message boards like you were talking
right.
about.
So, somehow I would find things and there was like, I remember there was like one other guy at school who also went into the business who we would like meet the day after Twin Peaks and be like, and talk theories.
Yeah.
And that was the thing we would do. But
I remember I could only find a tiny percentage of people who were into that show, but the ones that were ridiculously passionate about it in the most in-depth way.
Yeah, I was very, very involved. I remember my sister like went out to Seattle and brought me back like a T-shirt from the town. And again, I wasn't like a Star Trek kid or like a Star Wars kid who really collected that stuff.
Right.
But like my little pieces of Twin Peaks were like so important to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But prior to that, I mean, because this was before this, I think I saw Kids on TV when I was 5 or 6 or 7 years old and said, I want to do that. And I made my mother go out and get me an agent when I was a kid.
So acting specifically was kind of the first focus.
It started with acting.
Focus,
yeah, it kind of started with acting and just the idea that there are kids who are actually like actors who get these parts, who get to be on these sets. And so I think I was a bit of a ham. And not shy, and so, but not a good actor either, which was something I kind of learned as time went on.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe I might be better now, but back then, because everything I did, I played to the back row.
Oh, wow.
I was a very, very...
You had a theatrical
bend.
I had a theatrical bend.
And on top of that, especially when it came to like theater acting and stuff like that, I was always thinking of my next line.
Oh, yeah.
So there was never...
Not exactly living in the moment.
And how I would say that line. Like, I'd already pre-rehearsed what word I would put the emphasis on. So I remember this was a big moment for me as a child actor, that Fred came with me to an audition in eighth grade for like an episode of Blossom.
Fred Savage?
Yeah, Fred Savage. So Fred Savage came with me like to an audition for Blossom or something like that. And all the other kids see Fred walking in and like he's like a god. And I remember he was like going over my lines with me, my sides, and I'm like reading it and I'm like, I don't know how I should say this side. Like, why don't you read it one time? He was so much better than me. And not only was he better, but he gave like four different readings of the same line where literally I only heard it one way in my mind.
Right, and they were all great.
Every reading was completely like justifiable and interesting and different and like told like a point of view and told something specific about that character. All I heard was like, should the emphasis be on the or the of? That's all I could think of. So I would always get like far enough because I was like competent enough that I would make it to the callbacks. I was like callback kid. So everyone was like, there's something about him. But then when they put me with like the real actor kids, like I would every audition I went on was against Seth Green. Seth Green was on every audition I ever went on.
Did you book anything?
I booked a bunch of commercials.
Yeah.
And I got
anything we would have seen? National stuff?
I mean, like a Rice Krispies commercial, like what does your Rice Krispies say to you? You know, like a Ryder Trucks commercial, a Duncan Hines chocolate chip cookies commercial.
All right, so you're making bank as
a
kid.
Yeah, I was doing okay.
You're bringing in some money.
Okay. And then I got a couple guest spots on a couple TV shows. My other big claim to fame or my big wound as a child was I got fired from Punky Brewster.
Now, see, I saw this reference because I did do the research on you. Beyond
you
the IMDb, there is a reference. I mean, you probably told that story a lot before, but I need to, not on a podcast. I need to hear it.
Okay,
because it seems like, honestly, and again, talking about a different golden age of television, it seems like it would be hard to be fired from an episode of Punky Brewster.
One would think. As a 10-year-old, too. What does a 10-year-old have to do to get fired from an episode of Punky Brewster?
You would think they'd give a 10-year-old a lot of leeway.
You would think.
Yeah.
So either, a couple of theories here.
Oh, you don't know why.
Well, I have a theory in my head of why I was fired. Let's just say version one is I was so bad with my lines that they're like, we cannot make this kid work. But I think it was version two, which was, and this is a little bit of that other like side to me. First of all, I had a huge crush on Soleil Moonfry.
Oh, yeah.
So whenever I was in a scene and like Soleil would be on one part of the set and I would be on the other, somehow throughout the scene I would figure out a way to like move close to her. So I wasn't really following the blocking.
So you ignored all blocking.
I ignored all blocking. The other thing was I distinctly remember the director telling me to like stand here for something. And I said something along the lines of, like, wouldn't it be better if the camera was over there? Something about how, and to this day, I still think maybe my camera angle was a little bit better.
Yeah.
And then I remember there was the dog, Brandon. They had a dog, Brandon.
Right.
I remember one day, like, after the run-through or whatever, like, I went over to the side of the stage and I started petting Brandon. And Brandon's owner was like, the dog is not here for your personal pleasure.
Oh, no.
So whatever I did, I really upset the people on the Punky's set.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, it's also this, here's a clear indication that all that idea of, wow, it looks like fun to be on TV, be a kid on TV, then you're in a situation where you're going, oh, yeah, this is actually work, and not everybody here thinks of this as much fun as I do.
Like, it was a playground for me. Like, I get to flirt with Punky, I get to play with Brandon, and I get to tell the director where to put the camera.
Say a couple of lines, get a few laughs, and I'm out.
Yeah, I guess that they didn't see it that way. So I think they fired me the night before they actually shot it. So, like, I must have been that bad. They're like, we got to bring in any other kid we can find.
So they didn't cut the part. You saw the finished episode?
No, I got residuals for years and years after that.
Because you had to go do the thing.
And because I was still contractually paid out for the week or whatever.
Oh, wow.
And so, I had a small part in the movie Ghost Dad with Bill Cosby and Sidney Poitier directed that movie. Oh, yeah, Bill Cosby.
Notoriously terrible movie.
Terrible movie, yes.
Yeah. Is that the way Leonard's Part 6 is considered the pinnacle of bad
but
Bill Cosby
Ghost
movies.
Ghost Dad was certainly not far behind on that
list. Yeah. I don't even want to talk about Bill Cosby.
We don't have to. No, let's not go there.
Wow. So at what point were you thinking, was this where everything started to turn and you were like, maybe writing, maybe?
Well, Ghost Dad, I was in seventh grade.
Yeah.
So I think what started happening was my agents and I didn't see eye to eye. No, I don't know. I didn't go out for that. I started not going out for as many stuff as I started getting a little bit older, as much stuff.
Right. So you're also in that awkward, geeky
kind of
stage.
So, like, when I'm going like 13, 14, 15 years old, I think that we sort of, you know, the auditions were more like 7 to 12, that age range. And then I think the audition started to slow down. And then I started getting more into school and theater and that kind of stuff. So I think I kind of even stopped going out for auditions by the time I was 13 or 14 years old.
But you're still doing plays. You're still
doing plays. And then, and then the big change happened when I went to a theater camp in the Catskills in New York called Stage Door Manor.
Oh, I've heard of that.
And I feel it's like a famous theater camp.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of illustrious alumni, which I can tell you some if you care. But that was really the first time where, like, theater and being creative, not just with acting, like, it started to sort of excite all different parts of my personality, my brain.
That place comes up all the time. And again, my kid went to BU, studied theater there, and Stage Door Manor was something that a lot of his friends in that circle had been through and gone through. And yeah, there is a list of alums who have come from there that have gone on to be on stage and behind the scenes and directors, writers. I mean, there is something, it's fame for theater nerds.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
It's an amazing experience.
Absolutely.
It doesn't always translate to working in the business, but
but it does give you certain skills or certain confidence or certain something. I mean, the first summer that I went there, so that was just honestly, you know, I mean, credit to my mom. I said I wanted to be an actor when I was 6 or 7, and we went out and got an agent. Like, she knew I liked theater, and then she heard about this amazing theater camp.
So they were backing you the whole time.
Totally.
Yeah. Never questioned your interest in that.
No, because you know, it's like they tried. I mean, when I was younger, like, I don't know how embarrassing I want to get, but like, they got me a sports coach when I was like 9 or 10 years old. You laugh. Because they wanted me to be more athletic. And instead, I'm like coming in after school and eating like Doritos and Coke,
right,
and like, you know, watching cartoons. And they're like, we want him to be a little bit more active. So like, they would do things to try to get me to be more active.
Did they have an idea of what profession they thought maybe you should do?
I think they always knew I was going to do something arts or entertainment.
Yeah, okay.
Related. The fact that I was such a lover of television.
It was obvious from the beginning.
Like, what other 10 or 12 year old, you know, that's like reading Variety, and I can tell you every movie that's in production, every TV show that's on any hour on any network was really that.
Really, if most parents are just paying attention, it's pretty clear. Because, I mean, not that the kids choose their profession that early necessarily, but usually their habits and what they gravitate to, if you're really paying attention and you're just not ignoring the obvious.
Yeah, and I think they were really good at, if I showed any kind of interest in any specific thing, trying to boost that.
Yeah, encourage it.
Encourage it. You know, I played the violin for 6 weeks. You know, stuff like that. That I didn't like the way my chin and the angle was, so that went away. So I think we had a drawer of, like, my parents' broken dreams. You know? Things that they wanted for me that I would express this much interest in, and that it would just
For years, your mom would go in there and open that and just kind of caress the
violin.
Cry a little
bit. And
like, here's the football we tried to get him to hold.
Yeah, and ironically, so I have a 4-year-old son now.
Uh-huh.
And he has too many toys, we feel like. And he doesn't really understand yet that, like, gifts are that's a special thing. That's something you get every day. So his closet's getting kind of filled with toys. And we said to him, listen, if you want any new toys, you have to take one toy out of your closet. Just one thing. And if you give us that we can give away to another child, then maybe we can get you something else. So he goes, okay. So he goes in there the other day, and he's in there for like 5 minutes, and he finally comes out and he goes, I found the thing that we can give away. And I'm like, great, what is it? And he hands us a football. And it was like the one masculine thing in the whole closet.
Yeah, this is no good. I won't
no
be playing with
this football. So yeah, that's my son right there.
Doesn't fall from the tree.
It's fine. Yeah. I'm fine with it. So anyway, Stage Door.
Yeah. Well, coming out of that, so that was something that flipped the switch for you. Totally.
Yeah, so I would go there. I mean, there were a few things about that camp. First of all, there were 200 girls at that camp and 50 boys.
Sweet.
And let's say 25 of those boys were really nerdy or too young. Let's say 10 or 15 of those boys at that time were gay, but gay wasn't out. There was not an out thing. Now that camp, I think, is a lot more homosexuality. The whole,
right.
it became a much
they
more.
Yeah, they weren't openly expressing that, but it was.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking 1990, 91, 92. So it's a period of time where, like, even, like, we knew that there were certain boys that were, like, something was different, but we didn't really know what that meant.
Sure. You always understood that, and they tended to gravitate toward
each other maybe a little bit. But again, we didn't really have an understanding really at that age of what that meant. And I'm talking like 9th, 10th, 11th grade around that time.
Sure.
So that left like 10 mediocre Jewish boys to get the leads in all the plays and have these like 200 like budding experimental young actresses who were like in love with all these like Jewish boys who are suddenly playing like, you know, Proctor in Crucible and like I played Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream and George
and And things got close and intense, and you were around each other all the time.
The amazing thing about that camp is they'll do like 10 or 11 plays every 3 weeks. So every kid in that camp is in a show, and you're also taking classes. And so just by like being in the shows, being in the classes, and having this free time together, it just creates this like amazing, creative, free love kind of environment. It's the closest I could imagine in my head to what the 60s were like.
Except we're
just like making out with each other. There's nothing more than like kissing girls.
Apparently, but that's all 1967 was
that really.
Yeah, you probably.
I picture a lot more fingering. Can I not say that?
No, you can say anything you want.
I don't know what the word. Am I allowed to swear?
Can say anything you want.
I picture just tons of finger banging.
I'm assuming no brown acid is part of that either.
There was no drug. Okay, no drugs. Right. That was a weird. I mean, that was amazing. Like, you think theater camp? Like, I imagine the counselors, when the kids would go down for the night, they would just go out and get like shit faced. But like there were no drugs. Or just like a bunch of like 15-year-olds like playing guitar and like.
How have you not written that show? By the way, everything you just described.
I really should. I mean, the other thing too is I just remember like going up on the bus and like everyone's, instead of singing camp songs, they're singing like Sondheim.
Right.
You know, it's like that kind of stuff. But I didn't even know what Sondheim was when I went there. Like, I wasn't like a theater nerd like that.
Right.
But when I got to that camp, suddenly I was exposed to a whole world of theater and musical theater that was so not my life back at my high school.
Right.
And the other thing too is like you'd go to that high school that was also, you know, like talk about popular or not popular. Like, I would go to Stage Door, get the leads in all the plays. I had all these girls and girlfriends and all this attention. And then I'd come back to Brentwood where I'd be like a normal kid again.
Right.
And like, it's in Brentwood at my high school, Stage Door would do amazing productions with amazingly talented kids. And I would get these great parts and then I'd get back to Brentwood and I would be like the third pirate chorus guy in Peter Pan. Like, I couldn't get a part in my high school. But somehow at Stage Door, I did very well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing when you get around people of like mind that can confirm, because any kind of high school experience, unless you're in some kind of like arts or it's specifically vocational type school, you get that wide range of types and people and interests or whatever. I went to film school at USC. It turned out ended up in radio and podcasting, but that's a story we don't need to go through therapy for me right
I'd
now.
I'd love to hear it. I'm happy to be
your
therapist.
Okay, we'll turn the mics off and I'll cry and you'll hold me.
I'll cry with you.
But the moment you get around people of like mind, I had a similar experience with Northwestern. It has a high school institute they do during the summer.
The chair program. I also did.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay, so I was in the radio, TV, film, what they call it at the time. They've changed the
RTF.
Name of that.
Yes. I was there. I was in the theater department.
Theater department.
But I can talk about that versus Stage Door too, because that was interesting to compare those two.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, totally.
Yes.
But once you get around people, a lot of kids your age of like mind, and you realize I'm not the only one that is that type and can talk that, it is mind-blowing. And, you know, I still, and the way you talk about Stage Door and those experiences, it's still so vivid because there's just all these synapses firing
100%.
All the time.
And to this day, I mean, I just went to a Stage Door reunion in L.A. a couple weeks ago, and all, when you see, and it's weird, I don't know what it's like with you for these camps, and I don't know how much camp is interesting to the listeners.
But it's part of who you are.
But when you see another person who went to that camp, there's just that immediate connection. Yeah. And there's just that point where you guys understand what that means, and you have that bond with each other.
I'm still in touch with some of those people, and that was 5 weeks one summer before my senior year.
Right.
And I still feel connected to them in that way.
Yep.
It's unlike any other experience I've
had. And I know several cherubs who are out here.
Now, why would you, what's your comparison
First of all, just to tie it all together, writing started, I think, in a real way because of Stage Door. So my best friend at Stage Door Manor was a playwright, and he was a young playwright, and he was writing plays and winning playwriting contests all around the country. So by the time he was like 18 years old, he was like a young Neil Simon. He had written 75 plays. And he would send me his play. And a lot of them were like one acts, but like, you know, 15-page, 20-page, cute, funny, heartfelt one acts. And he would send me these, and I would read them. And then I started thinking, well, I could do that too, because I always had a little bit of a writer thing on the side. But I didn't actually think of what that meant. And so I started writing plays really because of him, and started winning this L.A. Young Playwrights Festival, which I won 5 times before I was 19 years old.
Wow.
But that all started because of my friend from Stage Door, who was a writer and kind of got me into that young playwriting world.
Oh, great.
So that's the writer link, if you wanted that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, so when you decided you were going to head off to college, was that the angle you were going for?
It was still theater arts.
Still theater.
Yeah, so I was a theater major at Brown, but I took a lot of writing, creative writing classes while I was there, and English classes and that kind of stuff too. But so I knew it was something with an art, again, still something in the world of the arts, but exactly what was starting to get more and more defined. by winning that Young Playwrights Festival a bunch of times. It's called the Blank Theater Company LA Young Playwrights Festival.
Yeah. They still have it going on right now.
Yeah. And after I wrote for it, then I became a director and a mentor, and I've been involved with it for like 20 years now.
Terrific.
So that gave me a lot of validation, and probably in ways that I wasn't getting from the acting. And also I started to see for the first time that I didn't need to be on stage or in front of the camera in order to feel that way, that there was something about, because I directed a couple things, I think at Stage Door 2, and starting to do the writing, I started to realize that I was getting more of a satisfaction from the creative.
So that was an easy transition for you. You didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I still acted all through college, right, and I still did the plays and all that kind of stuff. But within that, I also started writing more plays and started directing some stuff. So it started to expand out beyond just the acting, which was where it all started.
Right. All right, so let's get you to college, or this will turn into a four-hour discussion.
You don't want to hear the chair versus stage door debate? That's not fascinating to anybody beyond you and me. Let's keep going. Let's keep it moving.
Can you tell me in a nutshell?
No, you know what was interesting was that Northwestern, the chair program, was a conservatory. It was very, very strict and rigid, and you had to be at this thing at 8 in the morning, and you were out till 10:30 at night, and they took it all very seriously. And this was at least the summer I was there, and they put on these plays, but it was a very academic approach to it all, where stage door had a kind of a looser, more fun approach. And at least for me back at the time, I'm not trying to talk badly about either of these programs, there was something about the lack of inhibition that was there at Stage Door that I feel like carried through in the performances and the actors and everything that happened at that camp. And I feel like the quality of those productions were really high, whereas the rigidness of the structure of that, of the conservatory of that theater camp, having nothing to do with Northwestern on the whole, felt, I don't know what the word is, it felt restricting. It felt challenging. I didn't enjoy that process as much, and I also felt like the work wasn't as good. So I don't know why, because the stage was younger kids and a little bit more freedom. Northwestern was a little bit older and a little bit more rigidity, but there was something about that rigidity of that program, at least on the theater side for me, that felt obtrusive or felt not comfortable.
Well, I think different people respond to different. I know when we were looking at theater schools for my son, we looked at both types. And BU and he got into most of them. BU and Rutgers and Carnegie Mellon and all the conservatory style ones that had everything laid out year by year. He totally responded. He was like, I need structure. I need to be told what to do. We went up to Bennington in Vermont. Are you familiar with Bennington? I was walking around Bennington going, can I come here? It was literally like, design your own. Literally, I think you get a degree in whatever.
Yeah. Brown. Brown, you can design your own major. You can take everything pass fail. So it speaks to a certain kind of personality type.
Yeah, and that nothing about that spoke to Alex at all, because he needed to be at least. Now he's totally flipped that now that he's gotten that structure, and he's like, I'm gonna do my own.
Look, I believe my wife and I are having this conversation right now, and I think this actually does tie into creativity and what we're all talking about.
Yeah.
But you want to support your children and what they want to do. At the same time, I went to a college preparatory high school. Even my elementary school was very grounded in the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And I do think that you still need those fundamentals before you can go off and do other stuff.
Yeah.
This actually ties me into a Brown writing class story.
Okay.
Dude, you're like, I'm just leading the...
No, I like it. No.
So I was in a writing class. So most of the writing classes that I took at Brown, everybody else in the class was writing, playwriting stuff, was writing experimental theater. Nothing with characters and dialogue. I was like the one guy who was writing that stuff, and they hated me for it because they hated anything that was mainstream or commercial.
Or remotely traditional.
Yeah,
like
I took my intermediate playwriting class. I remember on one of my plays or one of my scenes, the teacher wrote at the end of the thing, like, you should be a TV writer. But it was not a compliment.
Right. That age, I remember in film school, because I was the same way. I grew up with TV, and that mass appeal entertainment was what I wanted to do, what I went to school for. And I was at USC, which was touted as
Spielberg school, and Lucas and all that.
And you could count on almost every screening there was going to be the one incest story. There was going to be one suicide story.
Right.
There was just this heavy drama.
At least
we were 19, 20 years old. We didn't know.
But
from
at least
that
you
crap.
Had stories. Like everything at Brown was nonlinear and hypertext. And stuff I didn't even know what it was, and they would attack me. This was what the LA kid was not like, because I represented everything that was bad and commercial in their mind about coming from Los Angeles.
Right.
So every class I was at Brown was a fight, and we could talk about what that was like. But what was interesting was in this particular class, so everybody was writing all these really experimental out there stuff. And most of it was really not good. But there was this one guy in the class, I wish I remembered his name. There was this one guy who everything he wrote that was very experimental and different was amazing. But I firmly knew and believe somehow that that guy knew all the fundamentals, that he actually could write a normal screenplay or a normal story, but was choosing this as his way to tell it.
Right, because he had already learned the structure and the basics of how to tell the story,
basics
and then
of
he started
drama.
To build on that.
Right, so he was playing off, it's like Picasso. If you see early Picassos, you see these drawings that he did when he was 10 years old that were these still lifes or whatever that are unbelievable. And he was so far above and beyond that that he got bored and started changing it into geometric shapes or whatever.
Right.
But he knew how to draw a still life. And I felt like 8 of the 10 kids who were doing experimental stuff in the theater class didn't understand the fundamentals. But the one guy who knew the fundamentals who was still doing experimental was so far above all those other people.
Yeah.
So I do think there is, you have to know the foundations of anything to then say, well, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. I mean, whether you have to appreciate the bare bones of what got that art form to where it got.
Right.
I mean, and I experienced the same thing. You know, we did a silly, Chris Black was my film partner, who's working on a thing with Kirkman, the Walking Dead guy, and you know, is running some shows now. And we did a very silly little short film about Santa Claus getting shot in the middle of the night. Great premise, perfect for a little 16-minute short, while other people were trying to do literally incest rape dramas in 16 minutes. We had this silly little conceit that we just... We had been shooting Super 8 movies forever on our own. You know, he was in Toledo, Ohio. I was in Odessa, Texas, and I was doing World War II epics in our alleys in Texas. We only shot what we needed. We used the allotment of film. We got it edited in time. We met our deadline. We screened it. It was funny. And then we got accused of not taking ourselves seriously.
By the teacher? By the
class, by the feedback. You had the entire Norris Cinema Theater on campus give you written feedback on it, and we got so much negative because we didn't take the course seriously. And it's the same thing. It's like, no, we really did. I mean, we wanted to make a good, short, funny film that was...
Your tone and your voice and what you wanted to do.
Yeah, we did exactly what we wanted to do.
Well, you know, some of that maybe has to do with academia and
also
being
the just hubris of that age of, you know, why aren't you trying to break ground?
Be important.
Yeah.
Something important.
I've never been one to be inclined toward depth, so that was never issue for
me.
No, not at all. In fact, all
depth
I'm going to...
is very overrated.
I'm just going to edit out the Punky Brewster story out of this whole conversation. That's all I'm going to release. Anyway.
That's how I want to be known, the guy who got fired.
So let's get you out of Brown.
Oh, we're done with Brown.
Well, no, but ultimately, did you make it a positive experience, even though it felt like a struggle all the time? Did you get into a rhythm of getting people to recognize that you had... some ability?
I think Brown was challenging. Brown was very intellectual when I was there. Mm. It was very, very liberal. And not that I'm not liberal, but there's a lot of PC stuff going on. I remember I was in an English class one day, and the teacher said, does anybody have any announcements? And one person was like, this group will be meeting in the quad at 5 o'clock today. And then another person raised their hand, like, the socialists will be meeting over here, the communists over here, the African-Americans, the neo-Nazis for Jesus. Like, everybody had a group and a purpose. And so everything...
Well, no wonder your silly little TV sensibility wasn't playing
correct.
There. Oh,
that's
my God.
Correct. So there was a part of me that felt that, you know, had I gone to a place that was maybe a little bit more fun, or maybe a place where that had a little bit more of a dating life or a mainstream social life, that maybe that would have been a more fun college experience.
Look, dude, you were getting all that finger banging action.
This is the problem. I got it out of my system at Stage Door Manor.
Yeah.
So Brown was the way to not have any of that.
Exactly. You needed a more intensive situation.
It's true.
Academically.
I didn't say I was doing the finger banging, and I don't think I said it about Stage Door Manor.
Oh, I just assumed that you were getting a lot of action.
Listen,
all the leads in the place and the pretty girls, and you guys are doing the close, intense scene work together.
Oh, I don't think we're close enough. I don't think we're close enough for me to tell the finger banging stories.
I was making the leap that you were part of that action. So I'm trying to give you a little
credit.
I
did okay.
That's what I'm saying.
What I was going to say, though, is in terms of Brad, you're asking about Brad.
Right.
I feel like, I got a lot out of some of the theater stuff and a lot of the academic stuff, but I found the social life, at least at the time.
And you're not exactly in the most exciting city in the world.
Listen, well, Providence has gotten better since I've been there.
Right. Like, I mean,
there's a mall there now.
Oh,
so,
wow! Yeah.
We had to go to Seekonk, Massachusetts to see a movie, and no one had a car. And you couldn't really go into Boston because you take the train in, but the last train came back at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah,
so if you wanted to go like clubbing in Boston, you couldn't really do it.
I mean, it's not a small town, but it's weirdly isolated,
yes.
despite the fact that it's in this massive population center in New England. It
yes.
is this own little enclave that has its own
weird, little island.
Until the Family Guy, you know, put it in prominence.
Yes, and Seth MacFarlane had not done that yet when I was there, so it was not. I think we had quahogs or whatever, however you call those. You know about that?
Yes,
quahogs.
Well, that's the name of the town.
Well, I think they're like clams, and
they
would serve them at restaurants. But I know that's like a thing of that show. I don't watch that show enough.
And it's apparently only available around the coastline of Rhode Island.
It might be. It's like a very Rhode Island specific thing.
Well, okay, now we got to Google that. So let's get you out of Brown. So
please,
you graduated with honors.
No,
you were paraded
not with honors.
No.
I remember going with my dad walking through day of graduation. There was like a cum laude line and a non cum laude line, and we saw some of my friends in the other line. He's like, "Why aren't you in that line?" I'm like, "Dad, I'm graduating from Brown. Isn't that enough?"
Yeah, come on.
Why don't you have the talus on the robe?
Oh, wow. Dad. Father.
Is that too
issues.
Real?
No,
is that too
issues
real?
With father. I'm trying to live up to a reputation, huh? Yeah, I want to make you cry at some point.
We could go Barbara Walters if you want.
No, we don't have to. I'm having too much fun. So, but
I have a little bit of depth, so we could go there if you want.
Okay. We'll see.
You know, I had a long distance girlfriend for a lot of Brown. I think that kind of took my head and mind away from that place a lot.
Right.
But it was, I remember it just being challenging, you know, it was challenging, but something kept me there. I didn't transfer.
Right.
And I think I was really stimulated by the academics and stimulated by the theater scene. And I acted in a bunch of plays. I directed a big play there senior year. So I was very involved in the theater stuff at Brown. And
I would imagine the sensibility of walking out of the door there is that, well, it's time to go to New York. That's where you go after you study theater at Brown.
There's probably some of that, except I had done internships for a few summers back in L.A. with Brown alumni in the entertainment business. So I had worked at production companies. And having done two or three summers of that, and knowing that that was something that I thought I wanted to do, I instantly...
So you had much better connections back here right away.
Yeah, but again, those connections were literally, I had two or three connections because I had, through Brown alumni, I had gotten these summer internships and working at production companies. And then I became, and these two guys in particular kind of became like big brother mentor figures to me who I worked for, who one of them was a writer, one of them was a producer, but they worked together at the time. And I came back out to LA and I said, "Do you guys know of any job stuff?" And one of them knew that somebody was looking for an assistant at New Line at the time. So I got a job almost right out of school working as the assistant to the senior vice president of production at New Line.
Did you have swimming with sharks moments there? Or
yes.
Did you?
Yes.
God, wow. That is not a cliche. I mean, everybody I've talked to at a certain level in the motion picture industry, that where there is that pressure and there's that money flying around and there is that guy who is that personality, there are way more of those than not. Those seem to be the rule.
I mean,
certainly not to the extreme of you know, physical abuse or whatever, but you do not get treated well in those assistant jobs.
It was certain. I mean, especially since my boss at the time had also worked for Joel Silver, and he had worked for, I think, a couple other guys who were of that ilk. So I think he grew up in that environment where you sort of, like, you follow what you saw, and I think
having the abusive dad, and you basically take on the traits
of
that.
Well, I think you take on some of that hazing, and it also... Like, it teaches you how to, if you want to be one of those guys, it teaches you. I mean, we would roll calls all day long and we would do, I was on it. Like, I very quickly, and that's not necessarily my personality, like, I learned how to function in a very, with a lot of product coming in, a lot of phone calls coming in a very high productivity kind of way in that space.
So did you sense high stakes there? Or is that all just kind of created? Is that just
an
illusion?
Was interesting when I was working at New Line, I was there when Michael DeLuca was still there.
Okay.
So I was there kind of the tail end of the DeLuca reign at New Line. And I don't know if you know anything about sort of New Line at the time. It's before it was bought out by Warner Brothers.
Right.
And there was still a feeling, this was kind of the tail end of it, but there was still that feeling that it was kind of its own independent rock and roll kind of.
Yeah.
It still had a bit
of
a looser
quality. They had a good run of some high-profile, successful small films, and that was what year are we talking?
We're talking like 98, 90. I probably started 90, like 98, 99.
So that is the tail end of a truly kind of these independent outposts that were they were jamming.
Yeah, and DeLuca would come in jeans and a t-shirt, and he's like running this company, and they're like, everybody kind of wants to work with New Line because they were making cool movies, and so there was kind of a cool, there was not a corporate feeling to it at all.
Right.
And my boss, like the year that I was there with him, like he got 10 movies made or something that year. I could list some of these movies for you. Some
That's
of them, like some of them didn't come out or only got released on video or something, but the amount that
but
was
they
happening
got,
and to be around
they
it,
got made.
They got greenlit and they got made, and to sort of be there on the ground floor to see that process and see how it was happening was very eye-opening.
In a good way, in a positive way, or just to have an understanding of it?
Well, to have an understanding for sort of how the system works.
Right.
And I think I got it. You know, it's one thing to read Variety when you're a kid or Entertainment Weekly. It's another thing when you're actually there answering the calls and seeing the calls coming in from the agents and the producers and the writers and the stars. And then seeing these, they would fill out these reports where they would say, like, you know, if we make this movie for $10 million, we'll make this movie for $10 million with this actor, but we'll make it for $14 million with this actor. And meanwhile, like, I think this was even before like foreign became that important,
right?
And it's like the two actors are talking about. We're not talking about like Will Smith versus some no-name TV actor. We were talking about like people who you barely heard of,
right?
So it was kind of like, what's the criteria? But also kind of viewing the movies as a business and sort of seeing how those decisions are getting made on a business level. So it was all informative. I mean, the thing for me, the most informative thing about it, probably just in terms of my career, was reading a lot of the scripts that were coming in every week.
Yeah.
And kind of feeling after a period of time that the majority of them were not very good.
Right.
And feeling like I had ideas of my own and being a writer myself and always being able to, I always had an ability, I felt, to read other people's scripts and give notes on that kind of stuff. That's why I probably thought I would be a development exec first. But
there are a lot of good writers that come out of script reading. That tends to be one of the first jobs doing coverage for at major studios or small or for producers or whatever. And you learn a lot by seeing how poorly some are written. And also it's weirdly encouraging, not that you wish anybody, you know, ill will with their project. It's like, good luck, I hope you get better. But you just recognize there are very few really, really good stories and really, really good scripts out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I also felt too at the time that, you know, my boss, this is before iPads and stuff, he'd go home every weekend with 15 scripts. And every executive is leaving every weekend with 15 scripts, and they have these big shoulder bags that they're wheeling out of the office. And there was just kind of a feeling like everybody in town is reading the same stuff.
Right.
Everybody's tired. And I looked at some of these people who were some of these executives at the time, and a lot of them have gone on to really big careers. But I just felt like, I don't know if that's what I want to do. And that was
right.
So in terms of sort of narrowing down the focus, I thought I wanted to be a studio executive, realizing that some of that job is not as creative as I thought it could be. Some of it's corporate and business side of it and all that. And also just the amount of reading that it took and everybody kind of chasing the same five projects or the same five people. Something about that turned me off to that aspect of it for me.
Yeah. So at what point are you still writing all this time? Do you have your own projects going on, or are you, does this take a while?
I'd written some plays in college, and I had written a couple things with my friend who had gone to Stage Door, who was that really prolific playwright. And I actually did a semester at NYU when I was at college. That was like I did the NYU film class, Sight and Sound, and that was like my big film semester abroad was at NYU.
Right.
And so I don't know if I was writing that. I don't know if I had time to write. Or maybe I wrote a play during that year.
So what drove you to start getting involved in the writing?
So I convinced that friend.
Yes.
So once I decided that I didn't want to be a studio executive, I convinced that friend to move from, and he was in New York doing coverage at the time. I convinced him to move to LA, and we became writing partners.
Ah.
And we spent, and I don't know how that choice came to be, but I think we both felt like we wanted to be writers. Why aren't we doing this? And we should do it together because we have fun and we like doing it together. And we kind of became motivators for each other.
Right.
And so we spent like 8 months working on a movie when he first got out here. And it was a really complex sliding doors type idea with like taking place in two different time periods. It was way for our first movie. We probably should have done something a lot simpler.
Way too ambitious.
And after those 8 months, like, we sent it to a few people. No one really responded. And we were like, how have we spent it? And it was all math, like trying to figure out all these things in the time periods and how they intersect. We're like, we got to be doing something else. We're like, why aren't we writing TV? Because we both of us liked the idea of being in a writer's room. We liked the idea of collaborating with other people and not just being the two of us alone in a room. And so, but in order to be a TV writer, you have to write, at the time, you have to write TV specs of shows that were already on the air. And we also thought maybe having that even structure would help us so that we are not just coming up with a crazy idea that's taking us way too long to write. So,
sidebar here, and we'll get back to that. How different is it now? Because Kushel went through this with me as well, because he's been embedded in the business long enough now where he doesn't have to kind of do that. He finds his next job because he's got a track record.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how to tell people coming up how to get into the business now, because it's just, you don't do that anymore.
Well, I think Kushel's slightly wrong. about his career.
What a surprise.
In his career, in terms of, Kuchel still also like writes specs and does his own stuff, like writes pilots.
No, I know, so but he's not trying to break in necessarily.
Right, but, yeah. But in terms of the way people view him, like I'm sure he has samples that he has written that people can read. Not he didn't intend for them to be samples, but you know, right. he wrote pilots that I think people read and say, oh, that we like this thing that we know about Bob, and we like this thing that he wrote recently. That so that sort of shows that he can write a family show.
But is that still the way you think? If I were to sit down and watch, oh God, what is even popular now that hasn't gone off the air already?
Let's say Modern Family.
Okay, yeah. If I were to write a Modern Family spec, that's such a specific voice.
If I were talking to you as a new writer, I would say I think that showrunner types probably want to see an original voice, hear an original voice on the page. So I would say if you're going to write two samples, I would probably at least make sure that one of them is original. Be it a play or a short story or a pilot or something. And maybe you write one, maybe you write a Modern Family too. But I would write the thing that feels like it's in the voice of the kinds of stuff that you want to be doing. So I have different writers that come to me and they say, well, I don't really know what I want to do. Should I be writing an Arrow or should I be writing Goldbergs or should I be writing Girls? And it's like, who do you think you are as a writer?
Yeah, what are you really good at?
I think
if
you're going to write a spec, and I'm not saying everybody should write a spec as a young writer, but I do think it can show that you can write in somebody else's voice. And more importantly, can you capture that tone? Can you capture the tone of that show?
Well, this is going back to, I talked to Ken Levine, who, did that kind of very traditional thing with David Dykes when they teamed up. They didn't have YouTube. They didn't have a VCR, I don't think. They recorded on a cassette player. I forget what show it was. It might have been All in the Family. Even before that, actually. It had to be much before that. But they basically just beat for beat, you know, wrote out several episodes of, oh, this does this and this does that. And that hasn't changed. I mean, it's basically...
Yeah, well, that's how we did it. So the first two things we wrote were a Malcolm in the Middle and a 70s show.
There you go.
And we got our hands on a few episodes, like four or five scripts of each. And we went through and we said, how many scenes does it have?
Yeah.
How much is the A story and how much is the B story? We knew enough of story to kind of understand that stuff.
Right.
And then we came up with our own stories that tried to emulate the story and the structure that they did on that show.
Yeah.
And Malcolm had only had like six episodes on the air when we wrote that. So it wasn't like it had been on for 7 years at that point.
But everybody's first looking for, do you understand structure? Are you even writing
I don't know how important specs are now compared to how they were 10, 15 years ago. I think, by specs, I mean spec episodes of shows that are already
currently
on the air.
Existing shows.
I think that there is value in having at least one of those in your repertoire, and, you know, just to show people. And I think it should be reflective of the kind of thing that you want to be doing. So if you want to be writing an hour-long drama, you shouldn't be writing like a crazy FX. You shouldn't be writing Archer.
Right.
So, but if you have an Archer sensibility, I think you should try to write some, you know, if you're going to be writing a spec and you feel like Archer closely matches your voice to some extent, write an Archer. I don't know if Archer is the right example, because you probably want it to be something that people know and are familiar
a little more
with.
Mainstream.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, and then so if you're going to have two samples, then they also can't be that different from each other, because I think what everybody's trying to look for is like, who is this writer? Like, what is their voice? So I think if you want an original thing and something that is another thing, you at least want them to sort of have some sort of correlation.
No, good.
Both be comedies, both be, you know, both have a little bit of edge to them, something like that, you know?
I got a great Friends episode I'm going to put out there.
That's still great.
It's on every day, nine times a day. Don't tell me that's not current.
No, that is not dated at all.
Wrote that with Bob's sister, actually.
Did you really?
Yes, I did with Lisa.
You guys might want to update it a little bit, see if the references still hold.
You don't think the you don't think the vibrating pager B story is? I don't even know how
I
we
think
would
you guys are
change
onto something.
That.
I don't know if that was good advice or not, but
it's very good.
The key to that advice is trying to figure out what your own voice is and what your own tone is. And whether that means you have two originals, two pilots, two whatever, that aren't episodes of shows that are already on the air, maybe that's okay. I just think, and I talk to a lot of young writers about this stuff, I just think that it's important, especially when you're first going out there, and I'm not trying to like put you in a box or pigeonhole you, but especially with agents when they're looking to send you out for their first jobs, they want to at least have some idea of how to sell you to the town. And
you have to have connection to some tone and some point of view that already exists, because unless you're just this spectacular wunderkind writer who's come up with a new form and a new take on, that nobody's ever seen before, and it's obvious, you have to have a connection.
Even now, I feel like if that's the case, you're probably going to have to go out and do a bunch of videos on YouTube that's that.
Right.
That
create shows your own work.
Create your own work or like make your own short movie. I mean, Lena Dunham, he still started off with tiny apartments, tiny houses.
What was that thing called? Tiny furniture.
Tiny furniture.
There was something very small involved.
I knew it was tiny.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, she started, like, that was proof of her voice. By her writing and directing that movie.
Well, I think that goes to the point of that there almost isn't a traditional path for any of that anymore,
right?
Because that way exists. It's
yeah.
it's a big crapshoot, but it does give you complete control over the exact product that you want to put out. That she went and made a movie herself with her own visuals, with exactly what she had in mind. Not everybody can do that, and everybody knows how to do that. And a lot of times, when they do that, it turns out really, really bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know the other thing that people like, people call me, and I sound like I'm this advice guru, but I actually do get a lot of people calling and asking questions and stuff. The one thing that surprises me so much of the time is people tell me that they want to come to LA and be a writer, and I say, what have you written? And they don't have stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the first advice I have for someone who wants to be a writer is you have to write stuff. And you can't just talk about writing. You can't say you have an idea that you're thinking about working on. You actually have to do the work.
And you really have to be okay with being bad for a long period of time. And this is goes to almost everybody I've ever talked to, because this is the thing I like to hear about, which is the path usually involves a ton of failures before, you know, amazing success. You know, it's like
my career has been the opposite, but we could talk about
okay.
That.
Yeah, that's right. You had the
success, and it's all been downhill.
No, you're fine. You're doing fine. But yeah, you have to be okay with being at least mediocre for a long period of time before things start to really make sense.
I'll tell you the other thing that you have to have, and this is the other thing I tell people when they ask me to read their stuff,
mm-hmm.
especially younger writers, is I will read your stuff, but you can't
and Austin's address is
but you can't get defensive with me if I'm giving you my thoughts or my notes,
right?
Because that's also a very young writer thing, which is I had it when I won the Young Playwrights Festival. Like, I thought my first draft that I wrote on the page was like brilliant, and we will not change this one word. And then I remember this. So this is actually something that happened with the Young Playwrights when I was a kid. I had a play that was 96 pages long, and by the time that we put it on, it was 56 pages, and we'd cut 40 pages out of it. And the first year that I did the festival, I thought my words were gold and we couldn't change anything. The second year, I learned the value of rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with working with writers. You know, you really have, if you want to be a writer in this town, you have to be able to hear the criticism. It doesn't mean you have to agree with or completely listen and do all the notes.
But parse out the stuff that actually can help your work.
Yeah, and it's like, especially for me, it's like, if I'm going to take the time to read something of yours and to give you my feedback, having been in this business a long time, I can't have you on the phone like yelling and disagreeing with me when I'm just trying to be nice and giving you my thoughts as someone who's been doing it for a long time.
Well,
it's a very knee-jerk reaction, especially when you're a young writer, to defend everything that you do or to get angry and that kind of stuff. And I like the emotion, the passion of it. But there's also something, too, where if you get five or six people who give you similar notes but not the same notes, to be able to figure out, oh, maybe there's something to this section that isn't working, or maybe there's something about this character that people aren't connecting to, if everybody has a problem with that character, even if their notes on how to fix it are different.
Well, part of it is that just sitting down, I don't know if you're this kind of writer, sitting down to write can be just so hard, to just the physical act of making yourself doing it. So when you accomplish something like getting a first draft, it's such a huge thing personally to say, okay, I got this thing finished. And the first thing you have to do is take somebody's notes on what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
And you want it to be perfect, obviously.
Yeah.
You thought that everything you did connected until people start to, you know, point out how ugly your baby is.
Right.
And it's an ego blow. That's a real, that's something writers have real trouble with and why they give up so quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have...
And why I'm podcasting.
I have different versions of that about through my career, and pilots that get close to getting made and not getting made. And early on in my career, when a pilot would get rejected, the depression that I would go into and the different ways that I've learned to cope through therapy and through whatever to not wallow in the sadness of it for too long. But I have certain
techniques
now.
It's impacted you that much when...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
because as much as I want to just treat it like a job and not get emotionally attached or involved, I can't help every single time that I go into something and putting it all, you know, trying my hardest, putting myself out there. And by the time it's done, I'm really invested in it.
Yeah.
And then when it goes away, I take it hard. And some of them I take harder than others. But the only way that I have learned to cope is I always make sure to have at least two or three other things, other coals in the fire, other things percolating, other ideas I'm working on, maybe something else that I've already sold, just so that you just can't put it all in that one thing, because it's so, there's so little rhyme or reason to a lot of the things that get picked up or don't get picked up. And I learned that when I only had one thing, it would really knock me out, and it would knock me out for weeks, and it would, like, I would not be able to work or function. And as a writer, you know, all you have is your ideas and your output. And so it's important to keep going and persevering. And part of that means not being so beholden to that one thing.
Not taking it personally is probably the hardest thing for anybody in any part of entertainment or whatever.
You can't not take, yeah. If you care. And I think most people care. You can't not take it personally. There are some people who are more of those journeyman writers who can kind of just come in and treat it like a job and clock in at 8 and clock out at 4 or whatever. And that's they got their work done for the day. But even those people, I still feel like some of them feel burned when the thing doesn't go.
I would think so, right?
The hardest thing, and this gets more into the emotional side of it, is not having your self-worth wrapped up in validation from the industry.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very hard thing for people who are like to be people pleasers, who have been told from an early age that they're talented and pretty and that everybody likes them and you're winning these contests and all that kind of stuff. Then when things start to not go your way, to not wallow in it, to not say maybe it's me, and you know, so you got to be able to find your own inner validation in other ways that don't connect to just the industry.
Right. Not a lot of finger banging going on in the real world out there. It's not that
easy. You're getting banged.
That's
I don't know where.
And it was never invited.
There's a lot of ass banging happening to me. Constant ass banging all day long.
Well, let's get to that.
Would you like to start?
So Jake in Progress, let's jump right to that, because that was this kind of flurry of like success that came at
I'll get to it really quickly. So my writing partner and I got staffed on our first TV show together when we were like 23, 24,
which was
it was called Glory Days. I can't believe I blanked on it.
Yeah.
And it was a Kevin Williamson show for the WB when the WB was still around, and he had done Dawson's Creek at the time, and there was he was doing Scream and all those movies. Mm-hmm. And we were brought on.
He was a very hot name. Yeah.
And we were brought on to be the two comedy guys on this one-hour drama.
Uh-huh.
Like, that was our role. And it was supposed to be a light drama, kind of like a Dawson's Creek. But they realized that they had a lot of shows like Dawson's Creek on at the time. So they said to Kevin, there's so many stories here, I'll make it fast. But they said to Kevin, like, you know what? You do, like, the horror stuff and the murder mystery stuff. Why don't you just take the show that you did, keep all the same characters, keep all the same sets, but turn it into a murder mystery? So suddenly he had this room full of, like, soft drama writers and these two comedy guys having to figure out how to do a murder mystery every week.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of a trial by fire. I won't tell all those stories, but once that show was ended,
that's
that show,
a little nuts to change something like that midstream.
Yeah, midstream. So then from that, we decided to write one more comedy spec.
Or mid creek. I'm sorry.
I'm going to bump it. No?
Okay. All right. Yeah.
And then from there, we wrote one more comedy spec because we really wanted to get on a comedy, and we got staffed on a show called Still Standing that was on CBS right after Everybody Loves Raymond. So we wrote on that for the first 2 years of that show together, and then in the middle of the second year, I created Jake in Progress.
Wow. Now, where did that come from?
Jake in Progress just came out of 24, had been on the air for a year or two at that point. And I just thought it would be funny to take all of the stakes of 24 and the visual style of it and everything and apply it to a romantic comedy.
Now, how remarkable was it in your mind, or was it? Did it just kind of come together really too easily? Like,
retrospect,
click, click, click?
Yeah. So what happened was I had this idea to do a romantic comedy version of 24, where each season was going to be one big day in the life of this couple.
Right.
So season one was going to be their first date. Season two was going to be their wedding day. Season three was going to be the birth of their first child. And you would put all the stakes of everything that could go wrong on that into a romantic comedy premise. And I sold it to 20th because I had kind of a little deal with 20th because I was already on Still Standing, which was a 20th show. And then we heard that John Stamos was interested in doing TV. And originally I thought the lead was going to be like a 27-year-old Jew. But like, let's make it for – I thought it was going to be me. You know, but like, let's make it for let's see if John Stamos is – and he was interested. And then John Stamos got on board, and Brad Gray, who was his manager at the time. So suddenly it went from this, like, I'm a story editor on Still Standing, to going to meeting with network presidents with John Stamos and Brad Gray and 20th. And at the time – I thought, oh, this is what happens.
Yeah, this is just the natural progression. Yeah. So you weren't intimidated by it. It was just like, oh, here's the next step.
Well, I was excited by it, and I also felt like this is what I want to be doing, and so this feels right for me. This is what I thought at the time. And, yeah, I mean, and pinching myself a little bit. But, you know, and I'd been on Still Standing, which was a multi-camera comedy, and it was a very conventional multi-camera comedy, and I felt like that didn't really feel like my voice. Mm-hmm. And so I was excited to try to do something single camera and romantic comedy-ish, which felt more like me, a little more Woody Allen-y, James L. Brooks. That was kind of the world that I wanted to be living in. So the instant validation that I got from that was, in retrospect, surprising. But at the time, I think
it was happened. The goal. I mean, it was the goal. You wanted to create your own show that was your voice that you had control over. So, and it happened.
Right.
So excited, right. But you embraced that and you're like, okay, here we go.
Here we go. And then I wrote it and then they picked it up and then we made the pilot. And then the presidents of ABC got fired. And then a new president came in and he said, he brought us into his office. I think this is before the upfronts. And he said, I'm picking your show up for 13 episodes, but I want to lose the girl and I want to lose the 24 concept.
And I said, the romantic comedy nature.
And I was like,
and the entire basic premise that you.
Yeah, now remember, in 24, it's all. Like, the pilot ended with them leaving to start their date with, like, all these loose threads that had started for the night. And he's like, but we'll keep the pilot. And I'm like, well, how can we keep the pilot? Like, this is literally part one of, like, this serialized storytelling. He's like, that's the problem. So, at any rate, I'm like, so what's the show? And he's like, well, you know, like, John Stamos dating girls in New York City. Who doesn't want to see that? And I was like, okay.
I wish people could see the physicality of Austin doing the shucking and jumping. He's like, hey, like, yeah,
but for
course.
Me, at like 26, 27 years old, like, he's giving me 13 episodes on the air. And, like he's giving me, he is giving me a chance. And so then it became, how can we take this one thing and turn it into something else?
Yeah.
As we're doing it.
Wow.
And he even didn't even believe we needed a second episode. And I was like, well, I still think we need a second episode that at least wraps up this night. And he's like, all right, fine, but I don't think you need it. And they ended up airing at 8th. They didn't even air them together.
So it's out of order. Oh,
they aired them. Oh, that's just the beginning of the story. So that was. So I had my own show, and yet having my own show, there was so much having to really turn it into something else entirely. And like the one guy who was the enemy on the date, because he's their ex-boyfriend, they wanted to keep that guy. So I did like 3 or 4 episodes to get him from being the bad guy to the new friend. But then when they aired them all out to order, by episode 2, he was his best friend. So like all the things that I thought were important, clearly they didn't think was important. And then it was just about sort of John Stamos working at this PR firm and dating women and applying some of my emotional baggage onto John Stamos, which is kind of the lesson that I've heard before, which is, you know, write Yiddish, cast British. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression
no,
before.
No, I haven't. That's fantastic.
So, you know, that write Jewy and cast John Stamos. And then it's not too Jewy. So, but suddenly when John Stamos has my bad stomach and my neuroses and is popping Xanax and suddenly like that, it's endearing.
Okay. Yes, I can see that. Yeah, now, along with all that, did you have any difficulty in getting people to deal with you as a very young person running their own show for the first time? Did people trust you? Do you feel like you were able to step up in a way that, besides the network executive who's like randomly just pulling levers?
No, I think that there was well, how much of it is just being a showrunner in general, and how much of it is being the young guy in the room who's saying, this is what we're doing. And I had
because you're walking into a position as a showrunner that's almost all. Yeah, I mean, you're a manager. You're managing a group of people, and you're managing a group of creative people, and in many cases, very insecure people.
Yeah, and I
who
think
need constant
that,
validation right. about what they're doing.
So
is good.
I think if you're like, if I were to do it now, I think there were certain things that I would do differently, and I think that.
But did you take to that right away, or did? I mean, did you feel natural having to be in a position of telling people literally what to do?
What I felt was I was finally utilizing all different aspects of my personality.
Yeah.
So what I felt was, and what I knew about myself, was I never just wanted to be a writer. So I loved being in the editing room, and I loved being in casting, and I loved going down a set and figuring out how to fix in the moment. So I liked all those different aspects of it. But within that, I think there were things with, you know, how do you run a writer's room, and how do you make all the writers feel like they're included and that they're valued and that we're all contributing the same? And if you have a disagreement with an actor on set, what's the best way to handle that where there's not hurt feelings? And politically, with the producers and the network, how do you play the game? And this is true with anything that I've learned with all the pilots I've done since then. How do you give them what they want, still be a team player, but also still hold on to the things that you believe in without being difficult? So every step of that was a learning process and a challenge, and I think that I was better with some of those challenges than others.
Now, are you able to have some sort of real life outside of this?
During that time?
Yes.
I mean, probably not a lot. Yeah. Probably not a lot.
Were you involved at that point? Did you have? You married?
My wife was my girlfriend at that point.
Okay, so that stayed intact. We took
a break at one point. Oh. But I'm trying to remember where in the process that was.
It just seems with that much going on, and it takes so much mental faculty. I mean, writing itself, just being a staff writer and being in a room and going off and getting an assignment, and the long days that a lot of people don't realize that you guys put in on those things.
Yeah,
it's not digging ditches. We all know that, but there is a mental exhaustion to trying to come up with perfect line, perfect joke, deal with notes.
And then on top of that, even more than any of that, so all of that stuff, plus you have producers who are giving their notes.
Right.
Then there's three levels of notes. There's the producer notes, the studio notes, and then the network notes. And sometimes none of the three are the same.
Yeah.
So
I remember
that our producers would give us notes that would make us rewrite a script for 2 or 3 days that would then go to the studio and they'd say, why'd you change that thing from the outline? We like that. And then you got to go back. And then the network would say, well, that's a constant dance that you're doing.
And is somebody like Stamos at a level where he wants to have input and did he?
No, Stamos was a producer on the show. And Stamos and I started.
He had a name on the credits.
He had a name on the credits. And he took, to his credit, honestly, besides his credit, his actual credit, to his credit, he took a chance on like a 26 or 27 year old kid.
Yeah.
And he was meeting with everybody. And he heard my 24 idea. He's like, I'm going to go with the kid. And so that show, and this is what I've learned 10 years later, that show wouldn't have happened the way it happened without him being involved from the very beginning.
My chest is tight just talking about and it's impossible now after hearing that this actually lasted 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. But it's not atypical. I mean, this is the way shows get on the air. It's magical when things connect and everything works.
It's magical that anything gets on the air.
Even gets there.
And then it's even more magical if something gets on the air and is actually good.
That's insane.
And look, there are episodes of Jake in Progress that we did that I'm really proud of.
Right.
And I actually think there were certain things that were like ahead of its time.
You got some nice response from people. I mean, I watched it and there were some critics that were kind to it. I mean, it wasn't like roundly disregarded or anything.
No, I think part of the frustration was, or my frustration was, it wasn't. First of all, we never got to follow through with the original conceit,
right,
which felt like a more unique conceit to me. There have actually been a few shows since then that have tried to do that conceit.
Right.
So I felt like we never really got our due with that. So it was never really the show that I had initially imagined. I feel like by airing them out of order, and also at the time, ABC had no other like single camera comedies. So a lot of times we were airing our episodes back to back. So that's another thing that starts to factor in, which is, what's your time slot? How are, you know, so there's, we were on Thursday nights. Thursday nights on like at ABC at 8 o'clock at night was another dead time slot. So there's all these other things that are out of your control.
Right.
So that's another lesson that you have to learn along the way, is you can only do what you can do. And then there's so many things that aren't.
What the hell makes you want to stay in this damn business?
This is why I'm in therapy.
I feel like I'm keeping you too long and we've only just scratched the surface, because you have gone on. That's not the end of the story.
All right. This was fun. Thank you.
Okay.
I leave in the middle of my Jake in Progress misery.
Did we cover everything in that? Because you said you could talk an hour about that.
Not at all.
I mean, what are we missing? What are the?
No, I mean, the biggest thing was just simply how you have to change, having to change on the fly, and how you start off with this one idea and what you believe to be a clear vision of what that is, and then you're getting a show made, but literally you've started a writer's room, and you're like, all right, so now what are we going to do?
Well, so on the heels of that, how difficult was it to have to deal with that show going away? Or was it in some ways a relief because it wasn't exactly what...
No, it didn't feel like a relief. It felt like a disappointment, and it felt like a loss. And it also, again, I put my heart on my sleeve with all this stuff. So, you know, when it wasn't as received as great as we wanted it to, but we still got that second season. It was, again, that was sort of licking the wounds and then kind of figuring out what's next.
Yeah. And what was...
I think at the time I was under a deal at 20th, so I think it was back to pilots.
And how much are you?
I wrote on another show because I was under that deal. This is another fascinating story, a show that got picked up and then never went, that I was a writer on.
Uh-huh.
But these are just interesting stories, like how these things happen and then don't happen. But I don't know. I don't know how much time we want to spend on this stuff.
What's interesting to me is how much work there is in doing work on something that nobody ever sees.
Yeah. So that's been most of my career since then.
And pitching. I mean, you probably have been and are pitching constantly, and that's its own separate hell and universe and art.
So I've probably sold 12 or 14 pilots since Jake in Progress. And on top of that, I've sold 4 or 5 movies during that.
And
since that
none of them have
and
gone
And none
into production.
Of those pilots have been... I've been on TV shows, too. I wrote on Gossip Girl.
Right.
And I had a musical that I wrote that was on Broadway last year.
No, I wanted to
And I did
that.
The live sound of music.
Yeah.
So I've had other things, but in terms of like pilots and stuff that go, I have not had another pilot made since then.
And that's kind of the remarkable thing, is that you can actually make a living, a pretty good living, on stuff that nobody ever gets to see.
Right.
Which is a strange concept.
It's a strange concept, and it's also why it's so frustrating.
Right.
Because you spend 3 to 6 months on one of these projects, maybe more, and then all of a sudden, just one day, it just goes away.
Yeah.
And it's like because one executive read it and was having a bad day and said, no.
And you really can't, most of the time, you can't revisit that. You just have to write that off and say.
Yeah, there's a weird thing that sort of happens when one network passes on a pilot. For whatever reason, there's kind of a stink on it. And you could try to set it up other places, but I think the other places are wrapped up in their own development. Mm-hmm. And I think they think, well, maybe there's got to be something wrong with it if this place passed. We don't really want the other people's leftovers. There's a few famous stories over the years, like CSI, I think, was developed at ABC and then went to CBS. So like every once in a while, like one will happen that will become a thing.
Right.
But more often than not, once a network passes on a thing, it's basically dead.
All right. So let's talk just like quick sketches here.
Yeah.
Gossip Girl, good experience?
Interesting.
Again, body language changes slightly. Interesting. All right. It was a learning experience.
No, very interesting to be on.
How old are you now?
I'm 38.
Okay. So how does a 30-something Jewish male write for that voice?
Snarky.
Yeah.
Bantery.
That's all it takes.
Snarky and bantery.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, you kind of...
Again, I wish you could see the body language going on. There's just this thing going on.
Well, you could... It was less the voice and the dialogue that was hard. The harder thing was learning the structural template of that show.
Right.
So that show has 4 or 5 storylines going on in every single episode, and every single storyline has a twist in every act.
Right.
So learning season-long arcs and learning how to be so plot-heavy and in that kind of way, which isn't necessarily the way my mind works. I'm kind of I like to think of things from a more emotional story place than a, you know, we had jokes on the show that we should call the show at one point The Coincidentalist, because it's everybody so much of that show is everybody overhearing a conversation they shouldn't be hearing. And so,
but that's so girls, they do that.
So gossip.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
girls are always overhearing other girls. So but that was the biggest learning curve for me on that show, was learning how to think in that 6-act structure, soapy, dramatic-y kind of way.
So you weren't intimidated at all by the characters or age,
no,
or their point of view, but just learning that
structure.
Yeah,
no, the stuff, and I think that's part of why they said, we think you could maybe do this, was because dialogue-wise, I felt like I had a handle. I needed a little help with, like, some of the, who are the hot fashion labels right now and what's the club they're going to.
Right,
and,
right.
Like, you know, there was a lot of very wealthy, high-end Upper East Side lingo. So I needed some help with some of that kind of stuff. But in terms of the snark and the emotionality, that I was fine with.
Got it covered.
It was more of, like, who's screwing over who and whose business is trying to take over this person's business while this killer is lurking in the shadows. It's more of that kind of stuff.
Is it hard to just be a hired gun after you've had a little taste of what it's like to run a show?
I felt like that in my 20s after the show. I think that as time has gone on, first of all, it's so common now. People have their own show, and then the next year they're writing on somebody else's
right,
thing.
Right.
So I think back then there was maybe a little bit of, but that's ego. You know, there was ego associated with that. Like, how can I go work for someone else now that I've done my own thing? To me, it's just about, and I think about this now when I talk to my agents about staffing or something like that, it really just comes down to, is it a show that I like and the people that are nice people to be around? I think as to have a career in this business, mm-hmm, unless you're Chuck Lorre or one of 2 or 3 other people, you have to be fluid enough to go from your thing to other people's things and back and forth. And again, that kind of goes back to that idea of making sure you have different, you know, coals coals in the fire,
right.
Which is like, I have no problem now going on somebody else's show as long as I still have the ability to develop my own stuff at the same time.
How many balls do you have in the air, do you think, most of the time?
Several, because I usually have one or two TV pilot things going. I usually have a movie thing or two percolating, and now I have some theater stuff at the same time. So, and I have a whole board now at home, and I have lots of ideas, so I always have lots of things.
Do you have trouble focusing on one at a time? Do you get bored by something relatively quickly and have to go work on something else? Are you better when you have multiple things going on?
I have trouble writing two scripts at the same time.
Yeah.
If something is an outline stage, if something's an idea stage, and I'm writing something, that's okay.
Oh, wow.
But I can kind of compartmentalize in that way. So I can kind of spend those hours on this, writing the script, and then spend a little time on this other thing or read that book that I wanted, whatever. But yeah, actually, the physical act of writing two scripts with dialogue and characters at the same time, that's harder.
It's so immersive. I mean, I can see that. You really do have to kind of keep yourself focused.
But there's kind of a way that I've sort of figured out how to do it where it kind of works out where as I'm writing this script, I'm pitching this other idea. So just to make sure that the different things are happening at once.
Right. I hate to gloss over it, but I feel like
your viewers have turned off long time ago.
Listeners, that's okay. I know you're a TV guy. First date. I mean, it's kind of glorious that this thing happened for you in a way. I don't want to say full circle because that sounds
like your
career is over. But the fact that you
are something I don't.
This whole thing is just a lead up as an intervention of sorts. Yes, your career in show business is over as of today.
I knew it was just a matter of time.
Almost anyone who has appeared on this podcast believes that, actually. Did you have the concept for that in your back pocket for a long time?
No. So interestingly, I have two friends who are musical theater writers. Surprise, surprise. And for years, we would just get together and have lunches and kind of talk about different ideas. And they would talk about the stuff they were working on. And they were really Disney guys. So they were doing a lot of stuff for Disney theme parks, for Disney cruises. They had done like some Disney direct-to-DVD movies. And they had also been spending a lot of time working, doing a movie, a musical adaptation of the movie Secondhand Lions into a stage show. And they had been wanting to write something that felt a little bit more contemporary, that felt a little bit older and funnier. And so one day, like early 2010, we just sat down and we're like, we've spent all this time talking about ideas. Should we write a musical together? And for me, part of it, I mean, literally with all these pilots that I've written and sold, you do them enough times, it literally becomes the definition of insanity. You do the same thing over and over again, expect a different result.
Right.
And it didn't matter if I was writing a multi-camera, a single camera, an hour long, a cable show, a network show, big stars attached, nobody attached. They all had the same end results. But the thing that I hadn't done in a long time is go back to theater. And I really felt like it would just be fun to write a musical. There was no other agenda behind it. There was no idea of selling it or putting it on Broadway. But
how freeing was that? Just to go, okay, I'm just going to do this fun thing with these friends that I know who I respect
and
their
talent. And it was actually one of the friends who had the idea. He reminded me of this the other day, that he always liked the original idea behind Jake in Progress, which was kind of a real-time date scenario. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what if we did a real-time date scenario but kind of made it a musical? Mm-hmm. And then we started expounding off of that and thinking of, what if there's a couple on a date, and what we're really hearing are all the voices in their head that we hear when we're on a date with somebody.
Right.
So, something happens that suddenly their best friends, they're chiming in on the date, or their ex-girlfriend or their therapist or whatever, and that turned it into a theatrical conceit.
Yeah.
And then we just had fun writing it. We talked about all kinds of bad dating stories that we had and what are examples of things that are sort of true to every first date, the first impressions, the awkward pause, the check. And we kind of figured out ways to musicalize all that. And so we wrote this thing pretty quickly. And then we did one reading of it in New York towards the end of 2010, which is it's called 29-hour reading, which is the actors come in on Monday. You have 29 hours to work with them over the course of the week. And they learn all the songs, a lot of times learning the music. And you get a little time with them to go over the scenes. And I directed it. And they stand in front of music stands for 2 hours and they do your show.
Right.
And my friends, because they had a few connections in the musical theater world, invited 50 or 60 people to this reading that we did with some Broadway actors, and we got a few theaters and several producers who said they were interested off of that first reading.
Wow.
And one of the producers who was interested were the people who had just done Memphis on Broadway that had just won the Tony, or maybe it hadn't won it yet, I can't remember. And they had started Memphis in Seattle, because a lot of shows start out of town before they eventually end up in New York. And they said, should we see if this theater, the Fifth Avenue Theater, which is a famous theater in Seattle where a lot of shows have started, would be interested in maybe doing something with their show. And we're like, all right. So they sent it to the Fifth Avenue. Fifth Avenue said, yeah, let's do a 3-week developmental workshop. So we did this 3-week developmental workshop with them in 2011. That turned into a full-scale production that they did in one of their smaller theaters, like a 500-seat theater in 2012. Had this like 3-4 month sold-out run there, and from that they decided to move it to Broadway. So it was kind of this, in terms of musical theater, like most musicals, the gestation period is like 6 to 8 years.
Yeah, and develops in many different places before it finally gets there.
I mean, from kind of Genesis to Broadway was like 3.5 years. And again, it was a small show. It was a small show. It was 7 people in one set. And I kind of thought, best case scenario, we would play off Broadway and be one of those, like, I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change things.
Right. That's, and then runs for a long time.
But because of Broadway financial models, which is a whole other area I could get into with you, that I've learned about during this process, that actually off-Broadway doesn't really exist in the same way anymore.
Right.
And when you have 7 characters and a 6-person orchestra, it's just too big to sustain off-Broadway.
Right.
So, and there's a lot of reasons to sort of brand something a Broadway show to then get touring and licensing and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it just this thing that started off as just a fun little thing between us 3 friends became a Broadway show.
That's kind of great. And that's, again, a learning experience because, like you said, everything else kind of felt like it was rote at some point. You were doing the same. And here was this a whim, basically, that just becomes this thing.
Yep.
You kind of want to find that again. That's your new drug now, right?
Well, now that's...
How do I find that little...
It happened this past year because I took that opportunity and then I said, well, look, I've been wanting to direct for a long time, but I've been afraid of where to put the camera. Literally, it's not like talking to actors, right? It's just the camera.
Really? You mean your Punky Brewster experience didn't give you encouragement?
You would think so. I got the DP from Punky Brewster on the phone.
Make it up to him.
Yeah. I said, listen, buddy, could you help me out? Brandon, sadly, was not with us any longer, so we couldn't invite Brandon into the process. But I was able to get, so in terms of getting pilots made, I got a studio and a producer to give me money to go out and shoot a pilot that I directed. So I did that this past year, and that was another thing to kind of change the method so it's not just writing a pilot.
Absolutely.
And that was a great experience, too. And now, because of the musical thing, and I started doing TV shows with different... I just did a TV show with John Legend for Showtime. I just sold one with Christina Aguilera to ABC Family. So suddenly I'm in this, like, musical world now.
You did the Sound of
Music
book.
And I did the live Sound of Music.
The adaptation, right?
Yeah. So suddenly that's opened up new avenues in the theater world, too. So now I have a bunch of kind of theater projects percolating. And theater, you know, it just... Comparing theater to TV and all that stuff, not only the fact that that thing got made, but just going every night and seeing it with a live audience and hearing the reactions and being in a preview period where you are changing things every single night. Yeah. There's something about it that's very alive and very electric, and there's a lot of energy to it. And so...
Dude, it's stage door manner just grown up.
Yes. The amount of finger banging I got during the Broadway show.
Thank you. This is what I've been waiting for. This is the way we bring it all together.
I mean, you cannot believe how much finger banging is going on Broadway. It is rampant. Rampant fingering up and down those blocks.
Again,
48, 47, 46.
I'm giving you so many ideas. They're right there in front of your nose. Yes. If you don't do finger banging the musical, I don't know what you're doing.
Only if there's an exclamation point along with it.
Duh.
Yeah. I'll call up my friends and see if we can get on the first song right now.
Are you a happy man?
Wow, that's a really... You want to end on that?
Yeah, I do.
Well, this past Friday...
Yes?
At my mom's condo... there was actually a happiness workshop that took place. We had a couple couple friends come in and conduct this workshop on what it means to be happy and how can you be happy in your life. And we had a bunch of friends come in and learn some tools to be happier. I think.
Is this an issue with you?
Yes.
Yeah. Recognizing when things are going well, or just understanding what happiness is supposed to mean.
You know, my therapist used to joke that I have anhedonia, which was the original title for Annie Hall,
right?
Which is an inability to experience happiness.
Yes.
I don't think that's quite true. I think that I have happiness. I think that I can go negative, and I think that I have a tendency to look at the darker side of things, or, you know, talk about it in terms of the pilot process. You know, it's like, on the one level, you can say, like, you sold this pilot to this person, to this network, and you have all these amazing people involved. That's amazing, and you're getting paid to write. On the other hand, you can say, but it's not this, but it's not that, but this didn't happen, but it didn't become this. So it's really the prism that you choose to look at things through. And I think that I am...
Where does that come from for you? Is that
my dad.
Do you recognize that as his?
Yeah, my dad passed away. My dad passed away 3 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And thank you. And I think that my dad had a kind of work ethic and a sort of a nothing is ever good enough thing. And I think
you were in the wrong line at graduation. I mean, there's an example of that.
Yes, and I think he had that a lot in his own career. Like, no matter what he had, he always wanted something more. Mm-hmm. And I think a little bit of grass is greener. And I think that, you know, part of that is good because it means that you constantly are striving and trying to achieve. I think the other part of that is it doesn't allow you to sit with what you have and be appreciative of what you have. And so I think a lot of my therapy and a lot of my work, I'm not, you know, like one of those new agey people, but I think a lot of the work is learning how to appreciate what you have and living in the moment more. And I think my kids, I have two kids now, I think those kids have given me a lot of that happiness. And again, not trying to have as much of your happiness rooted in work validation, because I've had, you know, I had a lot of early success, and then I've had a lot of, luckily, I've steadily worked my entire career.
Right.
I've always had jobs. I've always gotten paid. I've always had things going on. I think there was a moment early on in my career where I thought I'm going to be this guy. And I think, you know, expectations are another thing that can lead to unhappiness.
Well, I think that just listening to this path that we just have gone through, the fact that you had this kind of flurry of that kind of success at a young age is probably a really good thing, and that you stayed with it, that it didn't drive you away when things didn't go the way that you wanted them to, because you've kind of got the hard stuff out of the way. Not that you've cracked the code necessarily, but now that you have a family and you've got the kids and you start to understand, you know, that there are other things that you can appreciate more, and you had this joy of this Broadway show come together in a way that you weren't even thinking about trying.
Right. And also, you start to recognize the longer that you do it, too, that it's cliche, but it's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Yeah.
And the more you play Compare and Despair, reading Deadline or Variety, where you're looking at what the other guy has, that's kind of a losing game. And I think that early success, then coupled with a lot of, you know, disappointing rejections, I think that brought on humility and brought on... An appreciation for more things. So I still have moments. I mean, I had a pilot at Amazon this past that I worked on really hard for months with a big international director a few months ago. And we spent so much time. I did like 10 or 12 drafts, and I thought that thing was gonna get made. And then they called like 3 days before Christmas and were like, sorry, it's not happening. Like, and that wrecked me for a couple weeks. So it's not... It's still there. It still exists. You still want these things. You care about these things. If you're an artist who cares, it's hard to lose that. But you can. But I think within that, you have to find balance, and you have to realize that.
If you didn't have that to some extent, then you wouldn't have some things to drive you just to, you know, move on to the next step.
Yeah.
But to let that linger, yeah, that can eat you alive.
Yeah.
I don't know you, but you seem like you got your act together. You seem like, you know, you're grounded and you're relatively, you know, with it, unless you've just got a really great way of hiding some terrible dark stuff.
No, I don't know if I get too dark. I mean, I get down on myself. I'm hard on myself.
Yeah.
But
that's okay.
But I think it's also like it also drives me, and anytime that rejection happens, I think I should just move to Mexico and open a shrimp shack. That's a little fantasy my wife and I have. Neither of us cook, but we like the idea of, you know, a place with chips and guacamole and just really good grilled shrimp and a margarita. Like, that sounds sounds like a nice, lovely place.
Doesn't sound terrible.
No, it does not sound terrible. I feel like our life might be happier after this happiness workshop where you talk about your intention. My intention is to open a shrimp shack.
Either that's the next musical. I'm just
shrimp
saying.
Shack the musical? You are a plethora.
It's a sequel to Finger Banging.
Yes. Not sure how those two are connected. Well, I kind of know.
Yeah, but I think you do.
At any rate, point being that, but I still really love ideas too. And so when that next idea comes, I somehow, whatever that rejection chip that happens each time, and look, if you're going to be a writer or an actor or anybody in this business, it's going to be a roller coaster. There's going to be ups and downs. You're going to have your share of highs and lows and rejections and all that kind of stuff. But somehow I'm able to lick the wounds, get excited about the next idea and the next project, and do it again.
Oh, now there's our uplifting note. We will not end on finger banging. We will end on that.
Why isn't finger banging an uplifting note?
All right. Then we just officially ended on finger banging as well. We somehow tied them all together.
It's beautiful. This is the magic of what you do here.
It really is.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey! Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.